Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and when he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
That's exactly right. That is what we aim to do at AppSats. We aim to provide a safe environment for you to process your pain and your trauma, figure out how to create more safety in an unsafe situation, and hopefully build your self-esteem back up. Because one of the things that we know is that your esteem takes a real hit when it comes to the partner betrayal that you've experienced in the past. You know, relational trauma is the worst betrayal somebody can go through. You know, it rates right up there with sexual abuse, emotional abuse, verbal abuse. Partner betrayal means that the one person that you are supposed to be able to count on, supposed to be able to be safe with. And what we know is that if you don't have that safety, if your spouse doesn't have your back, it's really difficult to know who you can trust. Now, sure, there are a lot of people who are in poor marriages where their husbands or their wives don't have their back. 100% understand and agree with that. And yet, what I do know is that it's important in any coupleship to build that back up. And when you're dealing with partner betrayal, there are so many other things that you have to build upon. First and foremost, you know, communication, boundary setting, consequences, you know, trying to juggle a normal day, figuring out what is going to make you feel secure. So, it's really important to find safe people in your life. Maybe that's a best friend or a family member, a sibling. Maybe that's the church or a synagogue. Maybe it's a counselor, a coach, a Stevens minister. And I got to tell you, sometimes you need to talk over with somebody neutral who are good, safe people to talk to. because it may be that you would hope your sister could be non-judgmental and hear the horror that you've been through and sit there with you and kind of contain those emotional feelings. And then all of a sudden you find out, oh boy, I misjudged this. She can't handle this. Now she hates my husband. She wants him dead. She wants us divorced. She wants me to move out. She wants me to kick him out. And that's not necessarily what you want. Because when you've been through this kind of trauma, you really need to keep things as low-key as possible so that your brain can heal a little bit and your executive functioning can come back and you can make rational, healthy, emotional decisions in a good way. So, we recommend APSATS counselors because they have been trained in how to be partner sensitive. They do know what you've been through. They understand that window of tolerance and, you know, that you're either overly activated, hypervigilant, anxious, not wanting to eat, or maybe you're wanting to hibernate, sleep all the time, just escape from the horrors of your reality. And the other thing that's important for you to know is that when you go to a counselor who understands this situation, part of the reason we understand is because we have so much experience with the good and the bad. You know, today we're going to be talking with Karen Tripoletti, and she is an expert on spiritual or institutional betrayal. She's made it her mission to actually work with pastors and church leaders and the faith community to help them to understand what this kind of betrayal is like for a partner. And she works with partners herself who have been institutionally betrayed. You know, what happens when you really take solace in your faith community and somehow they don't react and respond to you appropriately? I worked with a couple where he had actually worked in the church, and he was doing really good work producing youth ministry programming. And the wife actually worked at the church office part-time. They loved their church. They loved the church leaders. They were church leaders. They had a real fellowship. And then he confessed to the executive pastor that he had a pornography problem and that he was going to get some help and that it was greatly affecting his marriage. And he needed to confess that to get that of him, as well as he was looking for a hand up. He was looking for somebody who could maybe remind him of his strengths and say, you know, we got this together, and here's some good books that you can read, or maybe you want to go to Every Man's Battle, or Braveheart, or, you know, just really help guide him and mentor him. And within 1 week's time, they were both terminated from the church, so neither one of them had jobs, and they were told they could not come back to that congregation. They could not come back to that church. They needed to become members elsewhere. And they were both so betrayed. You can imagine the partners thinking, I'm the innocent bystander. How dare you do this to me? And they were really both confused because they both looked to the church to help them get through this crisis. On top of it, if this has ever happened to you, you know that you start wondering, hey, where is God in all this? What is going on that God would allow this to happen to me? You know, that big spiritual betrayal occurs typically whenever you find out that your husband has cheated, whether it be pornography, prostitution, massage parlors, escorts, web chats, you name it. You end up questioning your relationship with God. You know, wondering, how could this have happened? What did I do wrong? Why didn't you protect me? Why aren't you giving me the answers now? Why aren't you making me feel better? Because I'm praying to you. I'm reflecting on you. I'm reading the Bible. You get the point. So there's lots of layers of betrayal, and I can't wait for Karen to come on and talk about that, because the re-traumatization that occurs by a well-meaning but uninformed faith community can create what we call complex post-traumatic stress. You know, if you look at anxiety on a continuum, you have anxiety on the left, nervousness, worry, fear. And then as it gets a little bit greater in intensity and frequency, it can look like generalized anxiety. It may come through as panic attacks or a panic disorder. And then as it moves further in its intensity and frequency, coupled with some past traumas or some multiple current traumas, it could go into post-traumatic stress, which creates hypervigilance and inability to sleep or wanting to sleep all the time. All those characteristics I talked about earlier, tremors, heart palpitations, fear in general, racing thoughts, rumination of thoughts, you know, that kind of stuff. And then, if there has been previous trauma, that post-traumatic stress can move into complex post-traumatic stress, which means there's many, many layers of betrayal that a therapist has to help you work through and process. And that therapist may do that with talk therapy, with grounding and resourcing exercises, with body somatization exercises, or even somatic experiencing therapy, EMDR, which of course is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. That's a bilateral stimulation of the brain that can help, neurofeedback. I mean, this is when you've got to have a specialist that knows how to get you to a trauma specialist, or knows the skills, him or herself, to help you work through what's going on in the body and the mind, because the body does keep score. And even when the mind is beginning to clear up and feel a little bit better, you know, body will let you know when it's getting close to an anniversary date, or if the sound of a text occurs, and that's how you first discovered your husband's betrayal, by seeing a text. It's like all of these triggers are now managing you as opposed to you managing them. So again, Karen's going to be talking about spiritual betrayal, institutional re-traumatization in the faith community. And she's going to be helping you to see the signs. And it may be that there was a little bit of that that happened in your history anyway. You know, whether somebody violated your confidentiality in the church, or whether they just ignored you. They just didn't attend to your needs. So she's going to be helping us today look at what the signs are, how do they manifest, and helping you to determine what you might need to do if this kind of institutional re-traumatization has occurred. So this is a topic we haven't talked about. You know, we've been on the air since the beginning of June, and we are going to talk more and more about the different experiences that you go through So, Karen, welcome to Partner Betrayal Recovery. How are you?
Hi, Carol. How are you? I'm doing so well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're excited, actually, to be talking about this trauma because, you know, so many well-intentioned faith leaders and faith communities, they haven't been taught how to handle this kind of trauma that can occur within their congregation, and so they don't always do the right things. Can you describe to our listening audience a little bit about the key identifiers for a betrayed partner? What would a betrayed partner see or feel in her church community that would let her know that she's not in safe territory?
Great, great question. Sure. Maybe first just talking around re-traumatization in a faith community, just generally initially might help too, and then we can look at those identifiers that you asked so aptly about. So re-traumatization can occur when, let's say, a partner, maybe even one that's listening, is in dire need of support, maybe one who has silently struggled alone wondering about her spouse's sexual activities because she's finding things that seem to indicate an addiction in face of maybe his denial, or somebody that's just discovered an online or affair partner and is likewise totally devastated, who goes to a religious leader, a pastor, a rabbi, a bishop, a priest, minister, clergy, whatever the case may be, for help and counsel. And instead of receiving the kind of compassionate care, the validation, even resources and help that she's hoping for to sort of navigate this crisis and trauma, she receives something else. Now, it could be lots of different things, and we'll drill down a little bit more, but it could be, for example, chastisement. For maybe she walks in and she's chastised for suspecting secret sexual behaviors from her spouse, who may be, let's say, in a position of leadership in the community or the church. And that can stem from ignorance on the part of these well-intentioned leaders, ignorance of the fact that pornography use and advanced sexual addiction, like, they know no boundaries, right? They reach every demographic and profession. It
right.
could be. So re-traumatization could be, for example, that she receives counsel, which is maybe not really suited to her circumstances. I mean, if we think about it, her covenantal expectations, her reality's just been thrashed, and maybe she gets counsel that shifts blame onto her or assumes that she is somehow complicit or responsible, Carol, right, when, you know, she's not, and when the addiction in most cases has predated her even knowing her spouse, or any other counsel that can distort the picture of the betrayal that becomes more injurious and deepens the wounds of the partner, the ones that she already has, and they sort of add layers of spiritual trauma to that relational trauma wound that she's presenting with initially. So institutional re-traumatization can occur, again, when lots of these things happen, particularly when well-meaning leaders are misinformed about the nature of addiction or about, I would say, the level of duplicity and emotional abuse often associated with compulsive sexual behavior, and as a result say or do things that add insult to injury, right, or pain to existing pain. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when you said duplicity, tell our listening audience, what does that term mean in terms of the reaction of a partner in an unsafe environment?
So, and you're speaking of the partner speaking to the leader about that duplicity and what can happen? Is that your question?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, absolutely. Because lying is such a significant part of the addictive cycle behavior, the addict can often become what seems like a pathological liar. I mean, this is in their lifeline, right? So if a partner is going to a leader and shares with a leader the level of behavior that she sees in her spouse, often what happens is that this behavior sounds outrageous, right? And so often it can be that the leader isn't understanding fully the level of deception that can occur in addicts' behavior. So she becomes, if a deaf ear is turned towards her, or if she's questioned about what she intuitively knows or otherwise knows, then she can come away feeling like, my pain doesn't matter to God. You know, maybe my spouse is right and I'm just off track spiritually, and this can do a lot of damage that takes a lot of time to work through and repair.
And that makes so much sense, because obviously that betrayal has so many different layers. And you talked about it earlier that, you know, you wonder if God's betrayed you. You wonder if your well-intentioned pastor or leader may be in some sort of denial. I mean, you and I both know that this isn't going to be an epidemic. It actually is an epidemic right now, and that our institutions don't understand how to help. They don't understand what problematic sexual behavior is all about, and they certainly don't want to believe that it's in their own communities, and so they may be inquiring questions that don't reinforce to the partner that they're so sorry that she's going through this and that they're there to help her in any way, and she needs to help them understand how she's feeling, and all the things that would show empathy. Sex is an uncomfortable situation to talk about in any institution, let alone in a faith community. So what can the betrayed partner do if they've been re-traumatized in their faith community?
Well, there is a lot they can do. And again, still recognizing some of these things that show up as signs of traumatization when they walk out and they are confused, but they don't really know they've been re-traumatized, and putting a name on that can be helpful. And then I can talk through a couple of things that I do in my practice called voice that will help to identify some places where they can either reinsert themselves in the process of educating or just establish a safe boundary and then work with other professionals that can help them, whatever the case maybe, or whatever their decision might be. But I did want to say to your point first that you're right, that these faith leaders do need education around what sexual addiction looks like, as you said, so that they can really listen and be a witness and understand her full story. I think what happens often is, in some cases, is that church leaders then who aren't familiar with it, to your point, will attempt to counsel, right, by resting or taking verses of scripture out of context and hoping of fixing maybe some perceived problem in the individual partner, which can mask the addictive problem of the spouse, right? Or they can misapply verses because they want to deal with something they're comfortable with or they know the answer to. And so often that will happen. If the whole story or the whole set of circumstances hasn't been presented to him, or if he's unfamiliar, like you said, with, you know, the nature of addiction, the cycles, the deception, the propensities, the partner trauma symptoms. Thankfully, more leaders are becoming educated around what this looks like, and I don't think it's a nanosecond too soon. But our goal is to sort of help them understand that full landscape. And I think to that point, too, Richard Blankenship said it well. He said, you know, when what faith leaders say almost carries a double weight, right, Carol? Because they are to represent, in a Christian community, the Savior, in other communities, the Word of God. And so in my mind, the implication is if someone is inadvertently dismissed or disparaged or devoiced or demeaned or discharged without validation, any of those D words, right, that it can do so much more injury to that partner. It's as if, I mean, I think of it metaphorically like this, is as if a partner is in a spiritual tsunami, right? She's in a tsunami of betrayal. She goes into the church for help, and the person from whom she's seeking it now throws, however unintended, another blast of wind and waves her way that cause her to sort of be overpowered and stunned. And let's picture that she's holding onto a branch and in this tsunami, if you will. And then that wave and that water just makes it slicker, and she's like sort of almost losing the grip that she barely had to begin with. And so now she feels more alone and hopeless. So those are, again, ways, first of all, that the person, the partner, can say, oh, I identify what's happened. I've come away from this interview feeling less than or doubting myself or in a position where I think the counsel that I've been given is, you know, not helpful to me. And we can dive down into what some of those four or five areas of injurious counsel might look like. But to your question mm-hmm. about what the partner can actually do if those things mm-hmm. happen, maybe we can return to them. One is to recognize that they have a voice. Obviously, as we know, trauma, in trauma, we feel our voice, we feel powerless and voiceless. And so to reclaim that voice, to recognize that they have a right to share their story, is so important, because often leaders may tell them that they're not able to tell their story to anybody, that they shouldn't be talking about this, and they silence women further. So one thing is to work with a coach or a professional who can help them identify how to get their voice back. I think, and there's opportunities to do that a lot of different ways that we won't go into right now, but to realize that they are an equal partner in the marriage and not a silent partner, and that the truth needs to be told so a light can shine into the darkness and it can be exposed, like we, you know, read in Deuteronomy, the scripture that says, and when we cried unto the Lord, you know, the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction. And I think, again, really understanding that and empowering the woman to see what that looks like and to know they have that entitled, that ability and that right and to sort of restore their voice is super important. I always look at and share with women the example of Tamar's desolation. You know, when she was raped by her brother, and even as she pleaded with him not to touch her, and she's told to hold thy peace, my sister, right? He's thy brother. Regard not this thing. And the devastation that occurred as she ripped her clothes and went out of that room, you know, mourning and with ashes on her head. And that then it was ignored by her father, David, whose credibility was lost because he had, you know, dismantled that through his own adultery. And so the scriptures record this horrible silencing of someone who has been a victim of infidelity, and I think there's a message there for us that we, as women, are allowed to share and should share with safe, trusted, seasoned, prayerfully selected others. So regaining that voice is part of what can be done. I think that's a B in the word voice. The next thing could be observe. Just, you know, it's helpful for a partner to journal and chronicle what is happening in these meetings and where the disconnect is between her reality and what's being perceived. Because often if she can identify those gaps and take notes on those, then she can decide, first of all, what the real narrative is. I'm big around creating this narrative that is accurate for her. And then she can decide whether to go back and revisit that with leaders or to go to the next level of leadership, or at least to own her narrative and craft it in a way that is more complete. And sometimes just journaling that and working through with a coach who can help her craft that narrative in a way that she can express it tersely and fully is super important. There's a lot more to that. I in voice would be to include. I would say that, you know, including in being asking to be included in processes that her spouse is involved with, if a pastor or bishop or clergy is going to interview the spouse, which normally happens, right, in light of discovery of addiction, then not to be kept in the blind. Often I'll hear partners who have not been part or privy to any of those conversations or results of those discussions. And so she's no way of knowing if he's fully disclosing or what's going on, and feels like an afterthought or neglected in these cases. And so to know that she can be included and that she has the right to ask to be included in those conversations is super important. C would be to communicate clearly what she knows, again, based on what she's finding, where the gaps are. You can always go up the ladder. I helped a client recently, for example, draft a letter to one of her regional leaders because the local leader didn't seem to understand what she was presenting and the depth of it. And in doing so, they took that information to a council, a disciplinary council, and used it to make the best decision. We're not trying to demonize the addict here. We want his full restoration. But if we give these things a pass and we don't deal with them appropriately and the leaders don't know the full breadth of it, they can't help a person, right, come to restoration, as you know. So the last piece would ties into that, and that's to educate these leaders. For those that are interested, because most of these are my own experiences, these leaders are amazing, consecrated people in most cases, and like you said, it's just a matter of we're not informed around sexual addiction in many cases, and thankfully we're catching up to that. But there are ways that the partner can work with a coach or trained professional or therapist to actually educate. We have materials, we will be having portals, but there are things that you can actually bring in and share with those that want to learn, or places that you can refer them. So educating them is all part of it. So those are a few of the things that you can do to sort of be proactive in dealing with the reeling back and forth of feeling less understood than you would like from one that you have gone to for help.
Well, absolutely. And for our listening audience, if anybody tuned in late, I am talking with Karen Trifoletti, who is a CEO of Sanctuary LLC. She coaches partners of sex addicts globally in the redemptive model, and she's an APSATS partner-sensitive trauma coach. And so she has made it her mission to help partners understand the potential betrayal that they may be experiencing. I loved when you said earlier, Karen, that when a woman walks out from an experience with her pastor, her church leader, synagogue leader, whatever, and they feel confused and they don't feel heard, and they feel on some level like they've been victimized, they need to pay attention to that. That's a first indicator that there's probably been some trauma inflicted upon her via that meeting. And so she needs to find somebody that's safe. And earlier you said that you help women figure out who might be a safe person to talk to. I mean, obviously, I said earlier before you joined us on the call that when somebody goes to an APSATS counselor or coach, they're ensured that we get how to be partner sensitive, that we know the trauma that they're experiencing because we've studied it, we've worked with it, and we've helped other people work through it. I mean, the fact that you helped your partner write a letter that concretely described what was going on in her betrayal really was a nice piece for the church to then take it up the chain and in a concise way. And let's face it, when our partners, the partners that we've been working with, when they've gone through discovery and the trauma of sexual betrayal, their brain doesn't always function well, does it?
Totally. Absolutely. I think you said it well. And, you know, they're just this whole idea of feeling safe. As a religious leader learns to listen to the whole story and validate the partner, because 95% of the time the research shows the partner is accurate, and what they say is often even less than the full reality, right? So they're not overstating. And so we need to educate religious leaders on that. And I think the other piece is, too, letting partners realize they're not safe if they're getting counsel that is a misuse or a misapplication of doctrine. So by that I mean things like we will often hear just forgive and forget, or just give him more sex, or you need to stop the witch hunt, or you're supposed to submit, or just trust him, or just put a filter on the computer, or just go to marriage counseling and resolve these communication issues. So educating a partner around protecting, in terms of the safety that you're talking about, protecting herself from the misuse of of things like that, she needs to understand what the teachings are on those things herself and be able to articulate that so she doesn't swallow it and say, oh, maybe that's all I do need to do, because I know partner after partner who have come away thinking, oh, it is all about me. I am to blame as a result of those. And we can address some of those if you'd like, but those are very often pat answers that are given or well-intended answers, but that don't take into account the nature of the addiction and the partner. Like you said, the absets understanding that this partner has really been traumatized and what that looks like and how some of these things can contribute to the addictive cycle rather than help either the addict or the partner.
Yeah, I would love to I'd love for you to share more stories, more firsthand accounts of some of the women that you've worked with and some of the things that they've heard. I mean, you just went through quite a list. And yes. What I know to be true is that, you know, we all have our specialties, and this is absolutely a niche for you. And I would say you're one of the leaders in our community for being able to help people work through institutional betrayal and spiritual betrayal. So can you share more of your firsthand accounts?
Thank you, Carol, and it is a passion for me. Having walked through this myself 13 years on the other side of the journey, it's a privilege to be able to give back a little bit, and I stand on your shoulders as well as all of the founders of Absets for the model that's been created to help us pave the way and to provide some education that way. That said, absolutely, around some of the areas that I've shared with you as, you know, things that are often said or rested scripturally. Let's see if I have a couple stories, and then I can touch on some of those areas here for you. So here's one woman said this. She said, my leader told me that emotional and verbal abuse don't really count as abuse. I calmly disagreed. He then told me that I had no right, as he pointed his finger at me, to ever talk to anyone about my husband's addiction and our marriage. I spoke up by saying that as his wife, it was my life too, and I actually had a right to talk with people. I opened the door and left and said, maybe another time. I held myself together until I got to my car and then fell apart, collapsing in on myself and erecting my defenses. So again, that's just an example of a partner not feeling heard and not a leader who was well-intentioned, who didn't perhaps understand what verbal and emotional abuse really looks like and the severity of it. Here's one. I'll read you a couple, and then I'll touch back on some of the things that we talked about that we may hear.
Yeah, that'd
not
be great.
And not know how to respond to the partner. Okay. So when I caught my husband acting out about a year and a half into our marriage, I was confused and hurt. I felt very ashamed and uncertain of what it was I was supposed to be feeling. Counsel from this church leader at that time was that I should be very nice, not be angry, and forgive. I was torn between hurting deeply and feeling like a good Christian woman. I was supposed to magically pretend that I wasn't hurt at all. Similar scenarios happened numerous times over the first 10 years of our marriage. I would catch my husband acting out. We would go to this leader. He would tell me what a good husband I had and that I needed to be nice, not to be angry, to forgive, and to give my husband more sex. Sorry, I just lost my little quote here. One second. I tried hard to be that good woman and pretend that everything was fine, that I had forgiven. At the same time, there was hatred for myself because I believed if I were just nice enough, sexy enough, that wouldn't be a problem. 10 years, now we fast forward, into marriage, my husband was arrested for inappropriately touching a 17-year-old girl. Shock, horror, disgust, pain, anger, confusion, guilt, shame, terror flooded my body. The worst part was there was no one there to comfort me. No one understood the depth of the betrayal I had experienced for all those years. There's a lot wrapped up in that, Carolyn, and to our partner audience, and maybe some religious leaders listening. What this idea that we need to Well, first of all, the idea of more sex is in here, the idea of forgiving and forgetting. Can I just address those with you? Would that be helpful?
Absolutely.
Okay. So just this idea of from the get-go, out of the chute, if your partner hears, just forgive and forget, it's just so premature and dismissive and hurtful to the partner. You know, I thought about the Brussels Terror Act, and I thought, you know, if we were there, can you imagine somebody running up to one that was just injured from a bomb or an act of terror and saying, have you forgiven the terrorist before we usher them to the hospital and for triage? Like, no, right? None of us would ever do that. But that's kind of what happens when a partner who's just shared this with a leader and their world has just imploded, it just kind of dismissively says, okay, well, just all you have to do is forgive and forget. Now, we're not saying that forgiveness isn't important. It is totally part of the healing process. But it's not the first thing for our partner to hear. It's not a, as you know, it's a process and not a switch. It's a gift through the Spirit that comes down the road. But to hear that right out of the chute when the tower of their marriage and the secure foundation has just been taken by terror and probably attacked more than one time, and they haven't had a chance to even survey the damage or mourn the loss, as you know, APSATS trained coaches and therapists make sure they have an opportunity to do, sends them reeling and making them feel again like their pain's not important. What they need to do is move right, is to take this bridge and go directly to a nice, neat, tidy ending of the story before they've processed any of it. Does that make sense?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. And, you know, you described it beautifully because it is so tough for somebody who is in that tsunami, as you said earlier, to be able to know if she's even safe, let alone begin a process of forgiveness when something seems so unforgivable, you know. And that process, I mean, one of the things that we learn in APSATS is that really, if forgiveness is going to occur, it's probably not going to occur until year 2, 3, 4, or 5. I mean, it's not something somebody can do overnight or within 4 weeks or 12 weeks or 6 months. It really is a process, and it's so dependent on the support they get from the addict and then the environment, the community around them.
Exactly. It's so perfectly said. And again, piggybacking on your comment about, you know, she's got to figure out the whole safety piece and lots more before she gets to that point. The other piece of counsel that this woman that we just shared was given was to give him more sex. And to your point, if there's not, like you said, we want a woman to feel safe, right, first of all. And as an APSATS trained coach or professional. And, you know, just to walk in and say, you know, if he gives you those, to hear from someone, you know, if he gives you those puppy dog eyes or, you know, just give it to him or just give him more sex, this has got to be part of the problem. When the addict is not in recovery and she doesn't feel safe, it just turns her into a prostitute. It turns her into the agent of his, you know, his deviant fantasies, essentially his learned porn behaviors. So that counsel, although, you know, it just usually comes also, I think, Carol, from an addicted spouse that's crying to the leader that he just hasn't had enough sex, right? And the leader may be misunderstanding the nature of his desires in the addictive state and or empathizing with him as a sexual desire as a male without realizing. And what I guess what the leader needs to understand is that more sex does not offset an addicted spouse's sexual acting out, and that this, even if the spouse, let's say, is not newly acting out, there's still more for him to learn about healthy intimacy. Like you said, healthy sexuality and understanding it in a way that honors God and the partner. And if she's not going to feel safe in that bedroom for a while, she is able to set boundaries around that so that she can feel safe. So to hear, just have more sex is not the antidote, is not the validation and the kind of support that she's going to respond to in a positive way.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's so helpful to hear other women's stories because it does bring about a sense of truth for each and every woman who's heard something like that, whether it be from their husband, from their sister, from their mother, or their pastor, mm-hmm. the faith community. So I was interested in, you said that you had your own personal journey and that you had run up against some of this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I sure can. And I was just looking to, I think I have, we'll hold that off. I do have another story too, so if you want, we'll come back to that. But my own, yes, experience, I'll call him Jack to protect him. But essentially, yes, I felt like I went through this tsunami. In fact, Carol and audience, I had a dream before all of this became manifest to me because the Lord really led me through this. This was at a time like 15 years ago. We were really talking less even than we are now, right, about all of these things. And so my leaders didn't know what was going on, and I had no idea what this was all about. But I had a dream that my whole room, I'd never seen a tsunami, my whole room, bedroom filled with water, and I was lying in bed, and I was brought, there was like a little space at the top of my room, and I was brought by the spirit or somehow, I don't know how, to the top of this water, and I was totally fine. And I was like on some kind of a raft or something. And I thought, well, that's an interesting dream. And then I later came to find out what that meant because the tsunami hit. And I was literally carried to the top of the water. And so I know there is a way to healing, and I have a very hopeful and redemptive approach to those partners that are going through this. That you know, there is a new that can happen at the end of this. But what happened for me was this was a very high tech person who gained remote access of my computer, who had me followed, had GPS on me because I was discovering things that I had no intention of discovering, didn't know what was going on. Typical of also many addicts, money was disappearing. My grandmother's dear wedding ring was replaced. The diamond was replaced with cubic zirconium so he could get some money. He was involved, then he brought in others and was involved in illegal activities, lies and covers. My phone was tapped. So what happened for me was everything I was trying to say was being undone as I was saying it because he was learning what I was saying. And so he was able to try to paint me into a corner. And in my case, he was very deliberate and intentional in trying to make it, in trying to break me. I'll just put it that way. That's exactly what happened. The Lord guided me in amazing ways through his word to tell me what was going on and what my next steps were. My daughter had a dream. I had a dream. Things were moving through just in a spiritual way that kept me going. But I went to my leaders, and this is a man who was a medical practitioner, very charismatic, looked like a teddy bear, could laugh off anything and make an excuse for anything. He was one that would be there setting up the choir seats. He would walk into a church meeting after I would explain what happened to my leaders, what's going on and what I'm discovering. Back then it was PDAs. I mean, our technology's come a long way. But he would have one PDA with family pictures that he would show our leader and say, oh, look, you know, this is what I'm doing on here, and she's all suspicious, blah, blah, blah. And in the meantime, I'd find the other PDA with the encrypted files and all of that. So this was, like, very frustrating for me. I didn't know how I was going to hold on. It did seem like that second traumatization was as great as the first. But the Lord sustained me totally, and his word was living to me. So I had this incredible peace in the eye of the storm. I mean, we were endangered physically in some ways because the group that he got involved with knew that I knew, and then I became sort of watched and observed. It was very scary for a while, and it was very easy. It would have been very easy, and as it is, I think, for some partners to leave the church. A lot of people will throw the baby out with the bathwater. Our leaders are incredible people, generally speaking. You know who I'm accepting. But They are. And for me, and I have a witness of the gospel and its power. And so I just happened to open up to Hebrews, and the Lord said to me, don't forsake the assembly. And I knew what he was saying. You need to walk through these doors. You need to go through this experience, and then you'll be able to turn around and help other people. So I did go back. My spouse was guilty of what Victor Klein calls, and we all know as partners or pastor present, the art of partial confession, where a slice of truth would be shared and the leaders would say, well, he shared this, and so why wouldn't he tell me the whole thing? And clueless about the range of this. So for me, I walked through that. I walked through what I would call also some partners may experience is disambiguous grief. That's where the situation isn't completely resolved. In some cases, when we work with partners, as APSATS trained therapists and coaches, we will walk through a full disclosure. That's a great way to go so we can get to the bottom of things, right? But when I ended up, after all this happened and my children were safety was at stake, I separated for 5 and divorced after that because he went down, spiraled down into an abyss. I guess what I was saying about disambiguous grief, for those that may be listening, where not all the pieces are neatly tied together. There was no full disclosure in a polygraph like we like to help partners through so that they have a foundation of truth for that they can present to the truth, their religious leaders, but for themselves to make decisions about where that marriage and the possibility of restoration is going to go. But for me and for many, that doesn't happen. The spouse remains in denial. The full truth isn't known, or there's trickle disclosures over decades or whatever it is. In my case, like I said, I separated and then I divorced 5 years later. So I've been 8 years divorced and 13 separated and divorced. So, but that disambiguous grief, you can still heal with that. That I do want you to know that I want partners to know that you can. And again, then thanks to you, after this happened and I walked through that and started, my new life, and thanks to you, Carol, Barb, Marcia, Dorit, Richard, Jill, Dan, all the founders and board of APSATS and other training that I've had, I can just truly tell you that God has given me water from the rock and that he does redeem, and that the waters didn't consume me like my dream and like it says in Isaiah, and that promise that held true like every promise the Lord has ever made to me. And that's something that I would like to help others through, because I have been through that. I'd love to walk alongside others and engage them in this healing process. That's pretty much it in a nutshell as far as that goes.
Yeah, that was a wonderful testimony of part of our process is to help women to know what is the best way to get the truth. And a disclosure and a poly is the best way, but you didn't have it, and you still were able to find your own personal truth. It doesn't have to be just one way. And obviously you've done the next thing that I think so many people, so many partners want to do, and that is that once they begin to heal and get stronger, they want to help others. And so you're living proof that after you healed and got really strong, you decided that you were going to help other partners, the community, and, be a conduit for God so that the spiritual betrayal doesn't feel as astronomical.
That is exactly my desire. It's interesting. When I had the experience with my leaders that I had, and I love these men dearly, they're amazing people, but they just couldn't see. They didn't know to see. And how can I, we had to be careful too what we expect, because we were hit blindside, we were living with this person. So I say everything I say about leaders respectfully, but that given, there's still a lot of pain in that re-traumatization, and you're right. So to your point about me wanting to give back, I remember leaving the leaders and saying, in X number of years, I'll ask of you now is that in X number of years, I can come back to you and spend 3 hours with you and tell you what this looks like when you find out that he has done the things that I've talked about, not to implicate him, but so that you know and you can share this with 200 other men. That was the request I had. I said, I won't need your plea for forgiveness at that point. I just want the opportunity to educate. So to have that opportunity now to go and present to religious leaders and share what this looks like so they can better help partners. And so that I can too as part of Sanctuary. Yes, you're right. Thank you, Carol. It's kind of a calling to me, I suppose, and a passion.
Yeah, I was going to say kind of, an absolute passion. We have to end, and yet let our listening audience know how they can find out more about Sanctuary and how they might be able to get a hold of you, because I know that what you have shared tonight, today has resonated with so many.
Thank you for your grace. So I am reachable either by text at 801-361-7571. My website, the business website, is Sanctuary for Women. It's SANCTURY for Women, FORWOMEN.org. You can schedule actually a free consult there. And you can also email me at Karen@sanctuaryforwomen.org. I would be privileged to, yeah, hear your story and walk alongside you.
Well, I'm going to have you back on because you are a wealth of information and knowledge, and we've just skimmed the surface by you sharing this information with our listening audience. And we really do. We have clinicians, coaches, partners, and sex addicts that listen to this show. So hopefully we have pastors and clergy listening also. And if you have a pastor or clergy that would like more information about this, please tell them to download this podcast. And our listening audience, they are our spokespeople. So please have them listen, because obviously you want to help the partner, but you know on a bigger global level, we have to get the faith communities on board to not only identify what these issues are, but in providing the right support to make everybody feel safe. Wouldn't you agree?
Well said, Carol. Amen to that.
Amen. And so I'm going to give you one more minute to share your last parting words with our audience who may be resonating right now.
Okay, well, thank you. Oh, I would leave, I guess, with a word of hope. I love this verse in Scripture where God says to one of his children, he says this, "Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread, I have given to you, even as I said to Moses, from the wilderness through the river Euphrates and all the land of the Hittites to the Red Sea, toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory." Now you might wonder why I would close with that, because I think that God is telling his children, like partners who have to cross a very formidable river, like the Jordan, right? We have our own Jordan rivers, that the land on the other side is already prepared and ready. The land... Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. On the other side of this betrayal trauma, that God knows, first of all, every pang in the way, but he sees beyond it. He secured that land that you as a partner are about to enter. He has secured your future and your victory, whether that victory comes as you heal or as your spouse chooses recovery or both. Blessings in your journey. There is a new healing and redemptive story that you may not be able to conceive yet. And that scripture just gives all of us, I think, hope that you can get there with the right help and resources. And God bless.
Absolutely. Karen Trifoletti, thank you so much. I love your emotion. It shows all of us that's part of your truth, too. So we will have you back on. And thanks for sharing all your wisdom today. You make it a great week, would you?
Thank you, Carol. Love you.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So obviously that's Karen Trifoletti is an amazing speaker and very passionate. Most of our coaches or therapists who have been partners, they get it. They know, and they know what not to do. So I hope you'll contact her if you're feeling like you've been through some sort of institutional betrayal. And I got to tell you, she's just an excellent coach for partners who want to find safety and truth in their own situation. So we'll see you next week, and thank you so much. As I say at the end of every show, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself and make it a good one.
For more information, go to appsats.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.